The big question, how do we kick the habit of buying too much from over there?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, good morning to you. I'm Bob Moon in for Steve Chiotakis. The government is reporting another whopping trade gap. It widened surprisingly and substantially in June. Marketplace's Jeff Horwich joins us live now with the big question, why we're buying so much more from overseas than we're selling. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Bob.
So how bad is it? How's it looking?
Well, the trade deficit increased 19% in June. We imported more, especially from China, and we sold less to other countries. Even with the economy still slumping, we managed to set a new record for our imports of consumer goods. And this trade report approaches kind of an interesting benchmark. Our trade deficit with the rest of the world has now returned to roughly back where it was in October 2008 when the financial crisis hit.
Now, I noticed that today President Obama is signing the Manufacturing Enhancement Act of 2010. Is that going to address this trade gap?
Well, that's the hope. The main effect of the act is to suspend the import tax on a whole bunch of products that U.S. manufacturers need to buy from overseas, making them cheaper for the manufacturers to export. I was just looking through it, mostly a huge list of chemicals most of us can't even pronounce, but the bill also removes tariffs on certain herbicides, reusable grocery bags, and yarn made from carded camel hair.
Well, how much difference could this make, really?
Well, the National Association of Manufacturers hopes the bill will save about 90,000 jobs, and manufacturing hasn't fared too badly during the economic recovery compared with other sectors. Almost 200,000 manufacturing jobs have been added in the past 8 months, but they still have a lot of ground to make up for what they've lost during the recession.
Marketplace's Jeff Horwich, thanks.
You're welcome.
Let's do some of the other numbers. Tokyo's Nikkei closed down almost 2.75% today. Investors are apparently worried over the Fed's new concerns that the U.S. economy might be slipping. European stocks are in the doldrums as well, down close to 2% in London, Paris, and Frankfurt. The Dow lost 54 points yesterday. Results from Rwanda's election announced today show incumbent President Paul Kagame has won this week's general election with 93% of the vote. Since the Rwandan genocide 14 years ago, Kagame has worked hard to change his country's reputation and to make Rwanda a center for business in Africa. But as the BBC's Peter Gresta reports from Kenya, Rwanda's economic success has not been without controversy.
By any measure, winning 93% of the vote in a presidential election is emphatic. Since he became president in 2000, Paul Kagame has ushered in a period of political and economic stability. Rwanda's economy has grown steadily by around 6% a year, and he has attracted foreign investment by assembling one of the most efficient and least corrupt governments in Africa. At a news conference in the capital, Kigali, an election observer, Salim Ahmed Salim, said the election day itself had run smoothly.
Observers have found a well-organized and peaceful poll. The National Electoral Commission has conducted the technical aspects very well, providing confidence to the people to turn out in large numbers.
But the election observers qualified their conclusions. They said a lack of critical opposition voices marked the poll. That's because a series of murders and legal cases kept most of President Kagame's serious opponents out of the election. The Rwandan government said it wasn't involved, but the election observers said the country still needs to address issues of political participation and greater media freedom. Despite Rwanda's success, analysts insist that more political space will only encourage further foreign investment. In Nairobi, I'm the BBC's Peter Gresta for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Yellow Book 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com.
India is fighting to remain a global spice hub. The spice trade dates back to the Greek and Roman empires, and its popularity hasn't always been a blessing for India, what with colonials often fighting over it. Now, some there are concerned that foreign companies have their eye on India's lucrative industry. Raymond Thibodeau reports from New Delhi.
This Delhi spice bazaar, known as the Karyabayoli, is one of India's biggest spice markets. Shoppers browse among burlap sacks brimming with cumin and bright orange turmeric powders, curries, and black pepper, which explains the sneezing as people walk by. Varun Grover owns a spice shop and an exporting business here. He says India's love of spices runs deep.
Yeah, it's a source of national pride. Indian spices are the best spices in all over the world, so no other country can come and take over it.
But the biggest food companies in the U.S. and Europe are eyeing India's market, including McCormick. The Maryland-based spice giant is buying a stake in an Indian company called Eastern Condiments, mainly for a bigger foothold in India's domestic market. Alan Wilson is McCormick's CEO.
It's the largest market in the world for spice production and consumption. We've been sourcing from India for over 100 years, so we have a long relationship there.
But Indian spice traders like Grover are worried. They don't like foreign companies muscling in on their turf. Some exporters say it's unfair, since Indian spice merchants often have trouble accessing foreign markets, especially in the U.S.
We have expertise in selling in those markets. We can certainly help them with the quality expectations and access to those markets.
That's exactly what Sri Kumar is hoping for. He's deputy director of India's Spice Board, which has been trying to attract and partner with foreign companies.
The Indian companies can have more access in foreign markets. And similarly, the foreign markets, they can promote their brand in India also. So it's a mutually beneficial thing.
Kumar says it's hard to know who benefits more. But one thing is certain. Despite the global economic slowdown, Indian spice exports are on the rise. Last year, $1.2 billion worth of spices were shipped out of the country, an all-time high. In New Delhi, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
Finally this morning, let me ask you a question. Are you drinking because you have no job? Or just maybe you have no job because you're drinking? We're talking during the hiring process. Researchers at the Universities of Michigan and Pennsylvania have been conducting experiments that suggest you're less likely to be hired if you're a job seeker who drinks in a social setting where a prospective boss is checking you out. And get this, your prospective employer may have a bias against drinkers even if they also order a drink during your interview process. Regardless of what the manager ordered, job seekers were perceived as less worthy candidates, seen as less intelligent, scholarly, or intellectual if they ordered, say, the Merlot. The study's authors have dubbed this phenomenon the imbibing idiot bias. I suppose a lot may depend on how you drink. That's what I thought. I'm Bob Moon in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Morning Report.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.